This is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future.
Georgia sent Donald Trump packing. For the first time in 4 years, we have the opportunity to define the next chapter in American history.
Early voting started this week, and Democrats need both wins to gain control of the Senate.
We all need to get on the midnight train to Georgia so we can get a triangular alignment of values between the House, the Senate, and the presidency to get things passed like the John Robert Lewis Voting Rights Act.
Republicans have advantages going into these elections. Historically, they've always won runoffs in Georgia.
People work really, really hard to keep us from voting, and we keep showing up.
We have a mission, and that is to serve Georgians.
In the words of Andre 3000, the South's got something to say, and that's all I'm gonna say.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright. Here's one of my pet peeves. It's when people say to me, why can't you just let go of the past? Quit bringing up old stuff. Move on. Look ahead. The sentiment just drives me nuts, which I guess is no surprise given that this show is all about how our history haunts us. But still, and there is perhaps no better example of why that sentiment feels so misguided than the runoff election happening in Georgia right now. In-person early voting started a week ago. I'm getting texts from my people down there with their just voted stickers, so shouts out to them. And to state the obvious, so much about all of our lives over the next who knows how many years hangs in the balance of this election. That's a partisan story, certainly, whether Democrats or Republicans control the Senate, and thus whether Joe Biden will have any chance to do anything of consequence with his presidency. But there is a whole other story playing out here, too. One that is arguably even more consequential. It's about a 57-year-old tug of war over black political power in the state of Georgia. And in some ways, this runoff election is kind of a test of whether black political organizers have finally slipped the knot that Jim Crow tied around democracy decades ago. That's how journalist Ari Berman has been telling the story of this runoff, and he's going to join me now to tell us that story, among other gems of knowledge that I'm certain he's going to drop. Hey, Ari.
Hey, Kai. Good to talk to you. Thank you.
You as well. So Ari is the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. He's been one of the most dedicated reporters on the voting rights beat for many, many years. He now writes about voting for Mother Jones magazine and as a fellow of Type Media, which, full disclosure, I'm a proud board member of Type as well as a former fellow myself. And Ari, I have to start by asking your state of mind, because, you know, I mean, for a long time now, in just about every election season, we do this thing where there's tons and tons of public concern about voting rights and about our failing democratic systems. And then just as soon as the election ends, that's basically the last time we talk about it until the next crisis. So is that as maddening to you as I imagine it is? And are you kind of feeling some trepidation about it now?
Well, in some ways, it's even worse, Kai, because instead of not talking about it, we had to spend a month talking about whether or not the election was stolen, which was just about the worst possible outcome for voting rights. So we actually had record participation in the 2020 election on both sides of the aisle. Mm-hmm. And there could have been bipartisan agreement that, you know what, mail voting worked for both sides. Early voting worked for both sides. But instead of that conversation, we had Donald Trump saying for over a month, and still saying, quite frankly, that the election was stolen, the election was rigged, and basically the entire Republican Party either repeating that, encouraging it, or saying nothing. So I would almost have been happier if we had no conversations about voting after the election than the conversation that we actually had.
Wow. I mean, I guess so then said, and we're going to get into the facts of what's been happening and what's going to be happening. But just sort of, is there anything then in the zeitgeist? I'm reaching here, but is there anything that feels different about our outrage this time, maybe because of the conversation we've been having about Donald Trump? Is there anything that suggests we might hold on to this long enough to actually to change something?
I hope so. I mean, first off, there was so much attention about the voting process in the run-up to the election, much more attention than usual because of the pandemic, because people were so curious and so concerned about how to vote, that there was a lot more conversation about the mechanics of voting and a lot more attention on making sure that votes were actually counted this election than in past elections. And I think that was a really good thing. And I think the fact that so many people did make a plan to vote is one of the reasons why we had record voter turnout. So I do think there's a lot of good things to take away from the election in terms of a lot of people used mail voting for the first time and liked it. A lot of people voted early for the first time and liked it. A lot of new people participated in the political process, and hopefully they'll keep participating. So all of those are things that we can take away that are good things in terms of how to make our democracy work better. But that's going to have to be pushed against this ridiculous, crazy, never-ending narrative that says not only is the election stolen, but we have to make it a lot harder to vote in the next election. And that's what I'm really concerned about, that all the lies about voter fraud that we're hearing are really laying the groundwork to make it much harder to vote in 2022 or 2024 and in future elections, because some Republicans still believe that higher turnout is a risk to their party, and they're going to do everything they can to try to prevent that from happening again.
Well, let's spend some time in the history first before we look at the future. So I began the show by saying there's a story playing out in Georgia that's kind of distinct from the partisan battle, obviously related, and that this is a story about the history of Black political power in the state and the effort to contain that power. So let's walk through that history for just a little bit. You've written about it. It starts in the early 1960s, just before the Voting Rights Act passes, with a guy named Denmark Grover. Who was Denmark Grover?
He was a very interestingly named state representative from Macon, Georgia. He was a segregationist state rep. And basically, Georgia had this very unique system that was essentially an electoral college system for statewide primaries. The Democratic Party ran the state of Georgia. And in the early 1900s, they instituted this system called the county unit system that essentially gave rural, more conservative areas far more power to select candidates in primaries, which was the only election that mattered, than more moderate urban counties. Mm-hmm. What that meant was that one way that Georgia reinforced segregation was through this county unit system. The Supreme Court struck that down in a very famous case called Gray versus Sanders for violating one person, one vote. There were all these cases called one person, one vote that basically tried to make districting and electoral systems more fair. And Georgia was one of those states in which it was struck down. So Denmark Grover created this system where if you didn't get a majority of the vote, you went to a runoff election. Now, the reason this was important was because Georgia was a state in which white conservatives were the majority. So anytime there would be a majority vote election, they would be able to win that. But they were concerned that you'd have a situation after the county unit system was struck down where a Black candidate, or more likely a white candidate that was supported by Black voters, could win with a plurality of the vote, meaning they could win with 40% of the vote or 45% of the vote, and white conservatives wouldn't be able to band together to stop it. So he basically said, we need to create this system that doesn't allow for a plurality winner so that we can prevent any Black candidates or any candidates supported by Black voters from actually winning the election.
And this happened to him as part of his anger about it. I was shocked to learn when I read further on it that he had lost his seat in the state legislature after winning the white vote but losing the Black vote by huge margins. And so he became obsessed with this Negro bloc, as he called it. And it's just kind of interesting to think about the fact that, you know, before the Voting Rights Act even, you know, they were actually doing the math of, oh, you know, white supremacists may become the numerical, the political minority.
That's what's so fascinating here is that this is all taking place before the passage of the Voting Rights Act. So Black voters are still marginalized in many parts of Georgia and are nowhere near as enfranchised as they are after the passage of the Voting Rights Act. But the writing is on the wall, and the segregationist legislators that have basically run Georgia for almost a century, for at least from the 1900s to the 1960s, they know that Black voters are going to become far more influential in the state, and that moderate whites and African Americans are going to be able to join together to elect more moderate leadership in the state. And they're very, very concerned about that happening. So they're trying to figure out what they can do to protect what is going to become eventually a segregationist minority in the state. And that's why they think, let's create this runoff system, which has two benefits. Number one, it allows white voters to band together to defeat anyone that's supported by black voters. But number two, they are also holding these runoff elections at very strange times. Remember, they are holding them after the general election. So they're holding them in late November or early December or January 5th in the case of this runoff election, which is not a time when people usually think about voting. And so they can try to turn out an electorate that ends up being older, whiter, more conservative, as opposed to a younger, more diverse electorate that might support less segregationist candidates.
And there's this great quote from Denmark Grover. I think this is from Denmark Grover, and it seems like it was in a deposition for a lawsuit, I guess, against challenging the system. But he says, quote, "We have to go to the majority vote because all we have to have is a plurality, and the Negroes and the pressure groups and the special interests are going to manipulate this state and take charge." So it wasn't like this is not subtle. This is the explicit purpose of this runoff system, as stated at the time.
Yeah, as stated at the time, that the point of runoff elections in Georgia was to prevent black voters from having any kind of influence in terms of who was elected. They were concerned about the very situation we are facing now, which is that someone like Raphael Warnock or someone like John Ossoff, who's supported by black voters, could be elected a senator from Georgia. And so they wanted to create this runoff system to allow whites to be able to block black candidates or to be able to block candidates that were supported by black voters from being elected. And it has worked, I'm afraid to say, shockingly well in the state, because runoff elections over and over and over seem to be electing conservative white Republicans as opposed to Democrats or candidates supported by voters of color.
How unique was this to Georgia? I mean, did voting systems change in similar or other ways around the South as black voters started winning more rights in the 60s? I mean, we talk a lot about the sort of tactics of voter suppression, one voter at a time, but not so much about these whole system ideas that try to facilitate minority rule. Are there other examples of this kind of thing at the time?
There are. I mean, there are other states that moved to runoff elections. There also was widespread gerrymandering in all of these states. So in the same way that Georgia in statewide races gave rural counties more power, they did the same thing in the state legislature. So you would have the rural parts of the state that were far more conservative than the more moderate urban parts of the state. They dominated the state legislatures, which were very, very powerful in a lot of these states, in many ways more powerful than the governor oftentimes. And so there were a whole series of tactics. But the thing that I find interesting is that runoff elections are more subtle than a literacy test or a poll tax, right? Like, you don't immediately put it together. This is designed to prevent blacks from voting or having influence. And I think that's what they were hoping for, that this it was something that you wouldn't be able to get rid of as easily as a poll tax or a literacy test. And indeed, we still have them today.
Let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about how the 2020 election may be the moment where black political organizers have finally figured out how to overcome this decades-old effort to limit black voting power in Georgia. I'm Kai Wright. This is the United States of Anxiety, and we'll be back with more from voting rights reporter Ari Berman. Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright. This week, we're talking about the history of containing black political power in Georgia and throughout the South. I'm joined by voting rights journalist Ari Berman. He's the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, and has been covering this year's election through the lens of voting rights as a senior reporter for Mother Jones magazine. And so, Ari, am I correct to say that you've been writing about the Georgia runoff and really the 2020 election there in general as sort of a pivotal moment in the history of Southern democracy? I mean, I get the sense from reading your work that this runoff is just kind of a test of whether Black political organizers in particular have figured out how to overcome a system that you've been describing that was explicitly designed to keep them from having power.
Yeah, but I think that's right. I mean, in Georgia in 2020 and now heading into 2021, Black voters have to overcome not just a system that was designed to prevent them from participating, but a current regime in Georgia that has been dedicated to trying to keep them from participating. So there's both the history of Georgia, then there's also the present day of Georgia, that a lot of people believe the 2018 governor's race was stolen from Stacey Abrams, preventing her from becoming the first Black woman governor in U.S. history. The architect of voter suppression then is now the governor of the state. And so despite what Donald Trump says about Brian Kemp and the current Secretary of State of Georgia being rhinos, they are, in fact, the people that put in place this system to try to keep Blacks from participating. So if Georgia were to go for Joe Biden and then 2 months later to elect one or more Democrats to the U.S. Senate, including the first Black senator in U.S. history from Georgia, that would be extremely significant, and it would have ripple effects well beyond the state.
Yeah. Well, we wanted to hear from somebody actually doing this work right now in Georgia. So we asked Inse Ufot to call us up. Inse is the CEO of the New Georgia Project. And by now, most of you are surely familiar with this organization. They've registered hundreds of thousands of new voters in Georgia in recent years, in part as a response to the Supreme Court's gutting of the Voting Rights Act. We'll talk about that in a bit. And the answer for organizers in Georgia was to build a whole new electorate that reflects Georgia's population. So, Inse, thanks for calling in.
Hi, Kai.
So it's really great to hear from you, Thad. I'm sure that you guys are running crazy down there. So I'm glad you made some time. I don't know how much of you were able to hear of the show, but Ari has been telling us about the history of Georgia's runoff system, that it was conceived literally as a way to limit Black political power. So I just wanted to start by asking you, I wonder about your own relationship to that history as you do this work of registering voters as a Black woman who's working to get Black voters registered in particular. How do you think about this election in that historic arc?
Well, I mean, I think that as we are thinking about building out the New Georgia Project and building out sort of Georgia's new electorate, it was very clear from the beginning that Georgia has a long and a recent history of voter suppression, and that it has clearly been designed to mute the impact of minority voting blocs, and specifically a Black voting bloc. Mm-hmm. And so while I have learned much more about our history, in particular the runoff and its racist roots in Georgia elections, from reading Ari's work and others, as an organizer, I see it happening in real time as we work to register voters, and then to find out that, you know, the state has a massive scheme to purge voters, to shutter polling locations, to add signature match, to make it more difficult for people to vote by mail, et cetera. And so, you know, some of the tactics that we organize against are the sort of tried and true sort of racist intimidation tactics that people are aware of or that come to mind when you think about voter suppression, right? Intimidating Black voters at the polls, et cetera. But a lot of the voter suppression that we work to overcome in today's elections are much more sophisticated, and in some instances appear to be race neutral on their face, like the voter purges.
Yeah. Well, I mean, on that score, you know, the Secretary of State, the Georgia Secretary of State has received a great deal of sort of positive national press about standing up to Donald Trump's campaign to overturn the election. But at the same time, he has been doing things in Georgia that have caused this question. There's been poll closures, and your organization has been accused of voter fraud. I just wanted to get you to sort of react to that and tell us how you see this the Secretary of State there now.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because over the past couple of weeks, I've certainly gotten a lot of inquiries. Like, do I want to offer congratulations or thank you to our governor and our secretary of state for refusing to participate in a criminal conspiracy to steal an election? I have not taken that opportunity as of yet because, they are doing their jobs. I'll be honest, I thought that as someone that has been subject to their, baseless investigations and their accusations and partisan attacks on our civil rights and voting rights work, I understand how awful it feels to be accused of doing something nefarious when you are just trying to make sure that people are able to vote. And so I would say that that sucks for them. And I know what it feels like. And it also speaks to a larger issue. I mean, the fact that the national Republican leaders are disappointed in our governor and disappointed in the Secretary of State because they don't want to participate in their coup or this coup attempt is a larger indictment on the Republican Party and how they're continuing to lose credibility with their constant attacks on our democracy and on our elections infrastructure, and it needs to be addressed.
So roughly 5 million people voted despite all of the hurdles in Georgia during the general election. And we've heard that early voting is once again happening in huge numbers, almost on par with the general election. So if the history of runoffs is that it depresses the black vote and that it was designed for that purpose, what's different now? Why is that appear to not be happening in this runoff?
I think there are a couple of things at play, right? So one, it has been sort of a central tenet of our strategy that while we wait to get chief elections officials on the county and state level who, will follow the rule of law and who see their job as to remove barriers to participation in our elections, that the way that we can mute the impact of these voter suppression schemes is to have overwhelming participation in our elections so that regardless of the purges and the poll closings, et cetera, that we can know what the will of the people is, that we can trust that the will of the people is reflected in the results of our elections, that it's a lot easier for them to steal an election with, 10 votes here, 100 votes here, et cetera. But with overwhelming participation, we can overcome some of this voter suppression. So that's one thing. I think the second thing is that we're in the middle of a pandemic, and over 300,000 Americans have died. Georgia, the COVID cases continue to rise. We have, nearly a dozen hospitals in rural parts of the state that are preparing to close or have already closed. There was one down in Randolph County in southeast Georgia that closed a few days before the November general election. And so people understand what is at stake here. Mm-hmm. And so our messaging, the direct voter contact that we've been doing is making sure that Georgians know and understand that with the power of their vote, they have the ability to save their own lives. And we have the ability to elect senators and a president who will co-govern with the people. And that message has been working. That voter education has been working. And we've been at it since March.
Before I let you go, I'm wondering if you buy my theory about this being sort of a historic pivotal moment in Georgia's history of democracy. I know you're in the heat of the battle. You're still trying to get people to vote in this current election, so it's hard to reflect on it yet. But does it feel like this is how does this moment feel to you in the sweep of your state's history?
It feels watershed-y. what we have seen, there's a lot of hand-wringing. So on election night, As we are digging into the data, looking at the numbers, it appeared as if President Trump was ahead on election night. But what we knew is that there were more votes to be counted in counties where we have been doing deep community organizing and electoral organizing. And if those ballots were counted, that we would have a ball game and we would be able to demonstrate that Georgia was America's newest battleground state. And so we've been bullish on Georgia and Black voters for quite some time. And 2018 felt like an opportunity to show that to the world. We saw, what happens when the Secretary of State is on the top of the ticket and refuses to relinquish his role and sort of as the chief elections officer. And what happened 2020 feels like it has given us another opportunity to prove what we've known for a long time, that this former slave state, this former Confederate state, is America's newest battleground state. Voters of color, in addition, Black voters in particular, but Asian American voters and Latino voters make up this multiracial, multi-ethnic, progressive majority in the Deep South. And that if we can hold them together, that we can, one, make sure they vote, and two, make sure their votes count, then we have a ball game. And so I'm looking forward to, adding an additional proof point with these runoff elections.
Insa Ufot is the CEO of the New Georgia Project, which has spent recent years registering hundreds of thousands of new voters in Georgia, trying to make the electorate reflect the state's diverse population. Insa, thanks so much for taking time to call us tonight.
Thank you so much, Kai. Take care.
So, Ari, speaking of 2018 and Stacey Abrams' gubernatorial campaign, both you and NC have mentioned it. A lot of people feel like it set the stage for the moment we're in right now. I mean, Stacey Abrams' history in the state is, of course, much longer than that. But we covered the 2018 race on this show, and I spent a morning with her as she campaigned during that race. And I want to play for you something she said to me then.
We're going to transform the electorate. We're going to bring new voices and add new voters. And it's hard for people to see that because they're so used to looking at the same narrative and the same composition of the electorate. Or worse, they're used to dreaming that something new will happen, but not putting the work in to make it so. And that's really what's different about our campaign. I don't believe that demography is destiny. I think demography is a pathway, but it takes work. And we are the first campaign in the Deep South to put in the work.
Abrams lost that election, of course, and you and others have written that 2020 may be really the completion of the work she's describing there. But I also have to say, I mean, she's implicating the Democratic Party in that remark, isn't she? I mean, the party is now, happy to celebrate Stacey Abrams, but didn't she have to fight them to get this far?
Absolutely. In the mid-2010s, around 2013, 2014, Stacey had this vision that there could be this majority in Georgia where voters of color joined with moderate whites to turn the state blue. And a lot of people were skeptical of that because Georgia Democrats, every election, they did the same kind of thing. They found sort of a presentable white person that was fairly conservative and centrist that they thought could appeal to those suburban white swing voters. But they forgot about the whole other part of the strategy, which is you have to not just get those suburban swing voters. You have to motivate new voters and voters of color as well to show up. And that part of the equation was missing. And Stacey realized it wasn't an either-or strategy, that you had to do both. But you had to have an actual strategy to be able to do it. And that started with building the organizations on the ground. And I think a lot of people felt like 2018 was going to be the time when this new coalition in Georgia emerged, and it didn't emerge. And I think a large reason why it didn't emerge was voter suppression. Right. But that laid the groundwork for what happened in 2020. And the fact that Stacey and so many others didn't give up after 2018, but they channeled their anger into organizing, I think made a big difference. Because even going into 2020, there were a lot of people, and I have to admit, myself included, that were very skeptical that Georgia would be a battleground state. They were very skeptical.
All these claims, but there just wasn't a lot of data suggesting it was true.
There wasn't a lot of data suggesting it was true. There was a lot of data suggesting that Democrats were going to get their hopes up again. And then on election night, when you saw this huge lead for Donald Trump, you felt like, oh, okay, Georgia's just like Florida. It's a state that's just going to continually disappoint Democrats. But Stacey and others, they didn't just see the coalition, but they put the work in to actually create it. And I think that's what laid the groundwork for Joe Biden's victory. And that is also, I think, what is making the runoffs, by all indication, very, very close again.
So what was it for the Democratic Party that made it not be able to listen to Stacey Abrams a decade ago, you know, when she said, hey, you know, there is a majority here if you actually engage more voters than suburban white voters? What I mean, I could speculate about some of the answers, but what do you feel like was it that got in the way, that why they couldn't hear that?
I think they were just reaching back to the past, and they thought, you know, who are the Democrats that got elected in Georgia? They were people like Zell Miller. They were these conservative white Southerners. And I think that's the only thing that people could imagine. They looked at the numbers and they said, well, yeah, African-Americans are 30% of the electorate, but that's only 30% of the electorate. Where's the other 70%?
Right.
And so it wasn't just that Stacey had a vision. It was that the demographics of Georgia have actually changed pretty significantly. There's been a reverse migration back to the South. So Northerners are leaving places like Chicago, and they're going back to places like Atlanta, where their grandparents might have come from. That's changing. So the Black population is growing in Georgia, but also the Latino population is growing. The Asian American population is growing. There are more moderate whites than before. There's more younger whites who have moved to the state, who are more progressive in orientation. And so the Georgia coalition of today does not look like the Georgia coalition of 1980 or 1990 or 2000 even. And I think that's one reason, I think, why Stacey's vision and other people's visions were able to be translated into reality, because there actually is a coalition here to be motivated. But I think someone had to actually show that it could happen. And I think the first step was Stacey's race for governor and coming so close in spite of all of these barriers. And then obviously Joe Biden winning the state, showing that it can actually happen. And now nobody doubts that Democrats can win these two runoff elections for the Senate. And 10 years ago, I think there would have been a lot of skepticism that Democrats would have even had a chance to win these races, let alone have a pretty good chance to at least win one, if not both.
Right. So the Secretary of State of Georgia, we talked about a little bit with NCA, has, as I said, gotten a lot of press for standing up to Donald Trump's claims of voter fraud. But at the same time, he's closed a bunch of polling sites and has launched voter fraud allegations against the New Georgia Project, I think, amongst others. Can you just quickly explain what they are facing now in the course of this election in terms of what the Secretary of State has been doing?
Yeah, the New Georgia Project and other groups that register Black voters have been accused of trying to register voters out of state illegally. There doesn't seem to be a whole lot of proof about this, at least pertaining to the New Georgia Project. Basically, what they did was they sent postcards to people so that people in New York, for example, could write letters to people in Georgia encouraging them to register and vote in the runoffs. But they weren't actually, people in New York weren't actually trying to register to vote to vote in the Georgia election. So, I mean, it seems like this could be cleared up pretty quickly. Also, the Secretary of State was angry because I guess he's had a son, a young son that passed away. And there was a postcard sent to his young son from the New Georgia Project encouraging them to register to vote. And that's an example of bad data, that the New Georgia Project was using lists either from the Secretary of State or from other publicly available data to try to find young voters. And there clearly were some voters on there that shouldn't have been on there. But if someone has deceased or moved or whatever, they're not, of course, going to receive that postcard. So it's not going to matter.
They're not going to substantively register from the grave.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing about dead people voting. I mean, if they're dead, they're not actually going to be able to vote. So I don't really, this could be maybe some sort of sloppy bookkeeping in certain places, but I don't think it's been any kind of voter fraud. And I think what the Secretary of State is doing is he's fighting two battles. He's fighting the battle against Trump because he doesn't want to seem like a stolen election took place on his watch. But at the same time, he is trying to mollify Republicans in Georgia that are doing everything they can to try to kick up voter suppression, not just for this runoff election, but also for the next decade as well. Because Georgia Republicans, when they convene in the legislative session in early 2021, I can guarantee you they are going to do everything they can to prevent Joe Biden or whoever is running in 2024 from carrying the state of Georgia again. And they are not going to want to make it easier to vote. They're going to want to make it as hard as possible to vote. And they're going to use the stolen election rhetoric to give them some sort of credibility to try to lay the groundwork for further attacking voting rights.
Up next, we'll talk about all the ways our democracy continues to encourage minority rule and how the Republican Party is already reacting to the huge voter turnout in 2020. And also, if you have questions for Ari about voting rights or the design of our democracy or anything, call us up at 646-435-7280. That's 646-435-7280. We'll try to slip in a couple of your questions. This is the United States of Anxiety. We'll be right back. Hey, everybody, a heads up that if you're enjoying this episode, I'd urge you to check out a couple of others in our feed that I think you'll like also. One is an episode we did just before the election where we talked to historian Carol Anderson about the modern history of the fight over voting rights. And another is a conversation I had with historian Eric Foner about our constitutional history, including why we don't actually have an affirmative right to vote in this country. There are links to both of these episodes in the show notes for this episode. So just go to your podcast app or WNYC.org, wherever you're listening, and look at this episode's description. You'll find the links there. And you should always, by the way, start doing that. We're now putting links to companion episodes in all of our show notes. So always be sure to check it out for more listening. Thanks. So, all right, let's start with what you talked about before the break, that you expect in Georgia and you have written in state legislatures around the country that that state-level Republicans are going to be making it much harder to vote in the next election because of the turnout in 2020. So what are you seeing that you want to point out?
That's going to be, I think, a very disturbing trend for the next decade, that Republicans are going to try to do everything they can to prevent another Joe Biden and to prevent these states from staying blue, or states that haven't gone blue yet from turning blue. And so I think we're already seeing legislation introduced to try to make it harder to vote by mail, which is a form of voting that Democrats used very effectively. We are already seeing legislation introduced to cut back on early voting because so many people voted early in the 2020 election. We are already seeing proposals to try to give state officials a lot more power to go after voter fraud, even though there haven't been any documented cases of voter fraud in this election. And I think the fact that so many Republicans believe that the election was stolen, because that's what Donald Trump keeps telling them, has really created momentum for these kind of efforts to succeed in states that Republicans can control, that in fact, you now have Republican activists, Trump activists, demanding that Republicans do something about what they believe was a stolen election, and that something is going to be legislation that then makes it harder for Democrats to vote and targets the methods that Democrats used to create record turnout.
Yeah. I feel like another overlooked part of this story is the state houses in general. You know, you talked about in 2010, the election and, you know, the way the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party kind of took over a huge number of state houses and have held a comfortable majority in the states ever since. That 2010 election had huge lasting consequences. Can you explain why and what happened in terms of democracy?
What happened was Republicans took control of all of these key states in 2010, like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and North Carolina. And the first thing they did was pass these incredibly gerrymandered maps that made it possible for them to actually get fewer votes than Democrats, but win a huge majority of seats. And to stay in power for the entire decade, that if you look at these Republican state legislatures in almost every single state where they drew the maps, they remain in power to this day, and they were not dislodged from power in 2020. So whether it's Georgia, or whether it's Wisconsin, or whether it's North Carolina, the maps are once again going to be drawn by Republicans in 2021, which is when the next cycle of redistricting happens. And in states where they have one-party control, like in Georgia, like in Texas, like in Florida, they are going to do very aggressive gerrymandering. And the Supreme Court has basically said, you have nothing to worry about, because the Supreme Court handed down a ruling last year that says that the federal courts aren't going to even review gerrymandering cases anymore. So state legislators basically have nothing to fear. Maybe in some states, these maps will be struck down in state courts, in states where there's maybe a progressive majority on state courts, like in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. But in Georgia, the courts are very conservative. They're not going to strike these maps down. And I think Republicans are going to try to lock in their power for the next decade by virtue of controlling the drawing of the maps.
This is one of the things where we've talked about with the down ballot races this time, where there was all this enthusiasm amongst Democrats that they would flip state houses. But I saw a stat from the National Conference on State Legislatures that fewer flipped than any time since 1946 in this election, which is really striking, given the stakes that you're describing.
Well, it turns out that people gerrymander districts for a reason, which is that it's really hard to undo a gerrymander once it exists. And I think Democrats had two problems with trying to win back these state legislatures. The first was that the elections took place under these gerrymandered districts. So they're trying to win races in places that were designed for Republicans to win no matter what happened in the national environment. And the second was that Donald Trump brought out a lot of voters himself. And so while that wasn't enough for Trump to win Wisconsin or to win Georgia or to win Pennsylvania, it was enough for them to keep these key seats. It's not enough to win races in Madison and Milwaukee if you're in Wisconsin. You have to be able to win more conservative, more rural areas as well if you're going to try to take back a state legislature. Mm-hmm. And that's where Democrats have really underperformed across the map. And so if Democrats are going to be a party that does very well in statewide races and very well in urban areas and in cities, but doesn't compete very well in more rural areas and doesn't really have any strategy to compete on more Republican turf, it's going to be very hard to take back these state legislatures, particularly because they were gerrymandered to try to prevent any kind of swing right in the national mood.
It worked. Let's go to Alana in Inwood. Alana, welcome to the show.
Yeah. Hi. Wow. Thank you for taking my call. And I love this particular show. Amazing. I have a kind of crazy question, maybe. John Ossoff is white, but he's also Jewish. So I'm just wondering whether you and your guests have anything to say about how that might or might not be significant, given the antagonism of the white supremacists right toward Jews as well as blacks.
Thank you for that. Ari, have you heard anything in Georgia that is about sort of targeting his Judaism or dog whistles to that effect or anything that would suggest this?
I remember in the runoff to the 2020 election that there was some dog whistling around this, that I think there were things where his nose may have been exaggerated in one ad that his opponent, David Perdue, ran. And I think there were stuff about connections to George Soros and things like that. So, I mean, it hasn't been as explicit as the racial attacks on Raphael Warnock. Mm-hmm. But I think it is an undercurrent here. It's also interesting to me that you have a black candidate and a Jewish candidate, because that's kind of like the old civil rights coalition where you see those pictures right from Selma, Alabama, right, and it's Martin Luther King marching next to a bunch of rabbis and a bunch of preachers. And that really was, in a lot of ways, the civil rights movement was a movement that was led, of course, by African-Americans, but also a lot of Jewish Americans and a lot of Americans of all faiths helped support it. And I think in Georgia, it's interesting. It seems like they're trying to, in some ways, recreate that. Mm-hmm. And there's a sense of history here, both in terms of Warnock, obviously, trying to be the first black U.S. senator from Georgia, but also Ossoff trying to create a sense of history for himself, too, that he represents this younger, more tolerant, more moderate Georgia, that it's not the Georgia of the past either.
Let's go to Gus in Richfield, Connecticut. Gus, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Given that the Republicans have a majority in most states here in the country. What can be done? You seem to be somewhat not very optimistic about it, but what can be done to obstruct or block gerrymandering of election districts? Thank you.
Thank you, Gus. That's a great question. All right, Ari, what can be done?
That is a good question. I mean, I think one thing that has to happen in 2021 that didn't happen in 2011 when the last maps were drawn is to try to make it as public of an affair as possible and not allow it to be something that's done in back rooms that nobody knows about. Because I think the more publicity that comes out about what's actually going on here, that politicians are trying to manipulate democracy for the next decade and essentially nullify the wishes of the voters, I think the more that we can create and make that an outrageous thing that people should actually mobilize and organize against. I'm not saying we're going to be able to defeat all of it, but you might be able to smooth off some of the edges of it. There's still a possibility of winning these cases in state courts. And so in a bunch of states, there are actually judges are elected to state courts, like in North Carolina and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. So those state Supreme Court elections, which often go very much under the radar, are very, very important. And then I think just the fact that gerrymandering, yes, it is meant to withstand shifts in the public mood. But that said, state legislative races are still often decided by a very small number of votes. You're talking about sometimes it could be 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 votes in some of these districts. And so I think if voters are mobilized in these areas, they can still overcome the power of gerrymandering.
What about the census? We just have a couple of minutes here, but you know, I do want to get to this. What we know that the count has been contaminated, I guess I can't think of the right word, by the Trump administration's effort to sort of disclude undocumented residents. The Supreme Court has chosen not to stop that. So what can the Biden administration do at this point, or anyone, what can be done about the state of the census right now?
So the Trump administration is going to try to exclude undocumented immigrants from the census count that's then used for House apportionment, deciding how many seats each state gets for the U.S. House of Representatives and by extension, the Electoral College. I'm not sure they're actually going to be able to do this because they're running out of time. The Census Bureau actually has to be able to send this information to Donald Trump theoretically by the end of the year, which I don't think they're going to be able to do. And then they also just might not be able to do it in any case because they actually don't know how many undocumented people are in the country and where they live. I mean, these are people that are in many cases under the radar for a reason. And so I'm not sure that Trump's going to be able to pull off this kind of scheme. But Joe Biden can reverse it. And he can also say to the Census Bureau, I want to make sure that you take as much time as you need to clear up any anomalies that are in the data. Because as you say, a lot of people are really concerned that the Trump administration tried to deliberately sabotage the census to suppress the voices.
And is that legal? I mean, can he do that? I thought the Constitution made it clear. I thought he had to take it. How can he give it more time?
Well, there's a lot of legal questions about what he can do, but he can ask Congress to extend the timeline for them to at least review their own data so the Census Bureau isn't rushed into releasing inaccurate data. And then if it turns out that the data is just really, really off, the House of Representatives can reject it. I don't think we're going to redo the census all over again because it's a 10-year project right. That goes into it. But I do hope that Biden can take something that's imperfect and make it a little bit more perfect in terms of what the actual count is, because these are results that we're going to live with for the next decade. Yeah. That's going to determine both political and economic power in America.
Ari Berman is the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. He has been covering the election through the lens of voting rights as a senior reporter for Mother Jones. And he's one of the just journalists who have really just been most dedicated to this beat over the many, many years. So Ari, thanks for your work and thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Kai. It was great to talk to you.
United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Jared Paul makes the podcast version. Kevin Bristow and Matthew Miranda were at the boards for the live show. Our team also includes Carolyn Adams, Emily Botine, Ginny Casas, Marianne McCune, Christopher Wirth, and Vera Lynn Williams. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Karen Filman is our executive producer, and I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. And hey, my email inbox is open as well. Hit me up at anxiety@wnyc.org to say whatever you want. And as always, I hope you'll join us for the live version of the show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. You can stream it at wnyc.org or tell your smart speaker, play WNYC. Until then, thanks for listening and take care of yourselves.